Okay, everyone, welcome. Appreciate you all coming out. My name is Benjamin Kamenetsky. I'm an administrator here on ISSY Cole. I also give a little part of a morning cheer, ironically, with my cousin, Rabbi Strahl-Benowitz, who's joining me today. And I'm excited about this. I'm excited about it because it's going to be a little bit informal. It's going to be a little bit personal. And we're going to get a chance to reflect a little bit. A little bit on our own lives, but also maybe taking it a little bit bigger, and to be able to try and tease some big ideas and some things that maybe came as a result of the unique way that we were brought up, but to kind of make that make a little bit bigger, make a little bit broader, and to see what we can accomplish and see what we can take away from it. There'll be some personal reflections about the different ways that we experienced childhood, young adulthood, and beyond. And then maybe we'll flip it and we'll sort of each focus on a couple of points that might be particularly relevant, hopefully for some of you, certainly for us, to think about moving forward. So, Rishra, we'll start off with some personal reflections, and I'll go, and then we'll flip. We'll talk about some points, and we'll see what we could be up to.
Well, thank you very much, just for Benjamin, for those words of introduction. I would like to start off, as Benjamin just said, introducing myself a little bit and telling you how special it is for me to be here together with you tonight. And I don't take it for granted. First of all, just for being in this room and for being a part of this Le'el Yun. There are, shout out to Rabbi Grazauer who just walked in, but really a round of applause for Rabbi Grazauer. All together, the amount of people who have reached out to me and texted me or called me to tell me how much they want to be here and how badly they wish that they can be here is really extraordinary. I know myself, I feel, and I gave this feedback to Rabbi Grazauer, there are too many good options to be at tonight, and no person can be in two places or more than two places, more than one place at once. So it's a tremendous zechus to be here. On a little bit of a personal note, as Rabbi Benjamin shared, we'll try to be a little bit personal and to share and to allow yourselves into a little bit of our lives and childhood. So I grew up, I was born in Washington Heights, lived there for the first few years of my life, and then later moved to Woodmere. I lived there for a few years before my family made Aliyah. I moved to Israel about 23 years ago when I was in the early years of my elementary school, which was a decision that my parents made, which was a big decision that they made. It wasn't definitely not the popular decision at the time. But I really had a connection through NCSY Kollel and through my experiences here to so much, and I really attribute so much of NCSY Kollel and what that represents to my upbringing and to the values and the ideas and the way that I was raised. When a person leaves a certain place and when you leave an environment, so a lot of times it crystallizes and it really confirms what it is that you really appreciate and what it is that you really like and connect to in that place or in that time. I had the privilege, as I said, my father is Rabbi Moshe Benowitz, not Rabbi Yisrael Benowitz, Rabbi Moshe Benowitz, who is the longtime director of NCSY Kollel, and I grew up on NCSY Kollel, in case you're wondering how long I've been on NCSY Kollel for. So my mother, who's in the back of the room, can confirm. My Pidyon HaBen, I was born in early June, and my father at the time was already the director of NCSY Kollel. And as you know, just like this summer, the NCSY Kollel starts usually around the first week of July. I am the oldest in my family. I am the oldest Bechor, I'm a boy, which means that I had a Pidyon HaBen. Pidyon HaBen, as you're all familiar and know, is 30 days after a first baby born is born, a boy is born. And my Pidyon HaBen was the day of the NCSY Kollel flight, the year I was born. So my dad, as the director, obviously could not miss the Kollel flight. That was his responsibility. So my Pidyon HaBen was actually in the party room of JFK Airport, for those who know or don't know, has a party room. It is a place where I guess they hold some sort of events, and that's where I've been doing events. So I've literally been on NCY Cola since I'm 31 days old. That is not an exaggeration. And I spent the first 21 years of my life here on NCY Cola, and then I left for a few summers. I left to spend summers in a different camp outside of Israel. And when you leave a place that has shaped you and molded you, like I said, it really begins before I was able to articulate what it was that I appreciated so much about NCSY Kolov, and what it was specifically the things that I missed most about those experiences. And the three things that I believe that I missed most about NCSY Kolov was, number one, was Shabbos on NCSY Kolov. I realized and I recognized how impactful those moments, those opportunities, and those experiences were, particularly, and if I had to specify one, make it a little bit less general, it was specifically Shabbos Nachamu, a feeling which hopefully Emirat Hashem will be zechus of experiencing together in just a few weeks from now. But that feeling of the achdus, of the singing, of the seudos of Shabbos, it's something that deeply impacted me. And it's something that really I missed when I didn't have it. I wasn't here. The second thing was being in Eretz Yisrael, being in Israel for Tisha B'Av, was something that was very, very valuable to me. And when I didn't have that experience, when I was outside of Israel, so that's something that I miss dearly and wish that I was able to be closer and be more in the fold of things. The last thing that I very much missed when I was in my hiatus, my time outside of NCSY Kolov, were the experiences and the interactions that I was able to have specifically on NCSY Kolov with my family, with my parents, with my siblings, with my cousins, Reb Binyamin and his siblings and his parents, my aunt and uncle. To be able to be enveloped and to be surrounded by family in such a way was something that was very, very powerful, and things that I really, really appreciated and valued. And I didn't even realize how much of an impact they had on me until I was lacking, until I was missing those opportunities. And the reason why I share that with you by way of introduction is really just to tell you that although, and we'll discuss, we'll get into it a little bit, my childhood may or may not have been a little bit different than yours, I would probably venture out to say that it wasn't so different than many of you sitting in this room. But just to value, I wouldn't trade that for anything. That upbringing and being able to be a part of a family, of being able to be a son of a rabbi, of being able to be a son of my mother and father, are things that I would not trade and I would not give up for anything. And I stand here as proud to be their son and to call them my parents and to be a part of this family. And that is, just by way of introduction, a little bit about myself and some of the experiences that we'll share over the course of the next few minutes.
Okay, so to maybe move a little bit into the topic of tonight, which is growing up with Blimey, specifically in the world of technology. So I'll just give maybe a little bit of a brief a background about my upbringing. I grew up in a probably, I guess, the beginning of an era, you can call it. I actually remember just to really beat the family connection dead horse here for a second. I actually remember I was first introduced to WordArt on Microsoft Word in the Benevitz apartment in Washington Heights. I was probably, it must have been 4 or 5 at the time. We can do the math later if that checks out. And I remember sitting there mesmerized by the fact that you could go onto a screen and just choose an image and it would be there. Like, that was like the craziest thing in the world. I remember it vividly. I made a poster with some Picasso Israeli Jewish star, a race car, and my name on it. And like a basketball. There was for sure a basketball on there. And like, that was like, I was blown away. It was on my wall for years. I had like long forgot where it came from, you know. And I was like, what was that from? Why is that on my wall? Oh, right. That's the first WordArt. That was my first, I guess, introduction to technology. And as I grew up through the high school experience, things changed rather quickly and began to develop. It was really very, very much the beginning. Just to give you guys a little context, so I grew up in elementary school. Everybody was on AOL Instant Messenger. that was like all the cool kids were on AIM. When I was in 10th grade, the first iPhone came out in 10th grade, and it was much less cool than a BlackBerry. Like, BlackBerries were it. iPhones were weird. They were clunky. They were, like, a little bit hard to use. Everyone was kind of like, oh, this might be it, but it's not it. And BlackBerries were for sure the thing. All the cool kids had BlackBerries. Brick Breaker was, like, the thing everyone was doing on their BlackBerry. That was still cool. And social media wasn't really a thing until the end of high school. The end of high school, people started to get Facebook. There was a couple of weird kids on MySpace. I still don't know what MySpace is or why it's not on Facebook and why it's only for weird kids. I'll never understand that. But somehow Facebook made it and fine, MySpace didn't. A couple of weird kids had MySpace in the early years. But I still remember there was a Sports Illustrated for Kids article. We got Sports Illustrated for Kids growing up. So Buzz Beamer in the back, can't miss it. But there was a certain column. They interviewed a bunch of athletes. Here, what's your favorite disc? What's your favorite disc? What's your favorite disc? MySpace or Facebook? MySpace or Facebook? I didn't know what MySpace was, but everybody picked MySpace. It was weird. It was like, what is this thing that everybody that all these athletes are doing? They're on they picked the wrong horse. What can I say? But MySpace, that was my upbringing. My own personal upbringing wasn't exactly that. There were definitely clear limits. There were definitely certain things that, whether spoken or unspoken, were things that other people were doing and not us. I was the last kid. I was the second to last kid in my elementary school class to get a cell phone. It was in eighth grade. I was the second to last kid. I to this day have no idea why that other kid did not have one. Maybe they just couldn't afford it. I don't know. But I was by far. I was. Well into the end of the path, getting a cell phone, and you felt it. Now, again, this is not what we're not. The focus here is not on my parents' clinic, and the focus here is not on how they did it and why they did it and what's the right way to do it. We can talk about that for hours and days and years, a different time. But in terms of my own experience, just to focus on that for a second. So there was definitely an awareness of the fact, at the very least, an awareness of the fact that we were a little bit different, and we. And we didn't necessarily do all the things that everyone else was doing. We didn't have a TV in my house growing up, and that was extremely unique. My parents compromised again, not to focus on the chinuch element of this. The compromise was that we had game systems. Game systems are you can curate the games that go into the game system. Once upon a time, you were able to do that. Now a game system is just a glorified TV or internet browser, essentially. But you could curate, you know, the games that came in. That was the line that they drew. So I didn't have a TV in my house growing up. So there were certain things that we got accustomed to, that we got acclimated to. This is just not just what we don't do. And there were certain things that I figured out how to outsource. There are certain things that when you figure out, you sort of, you know, you figure out how to play the game. I would park myself on one of my close friends, Ari Sofer. I would park myself on his couch from 12:30 p.m. on a Sunday until 9:30 p.m. On a Sunday. I had my spot on his couch. I would often eat dinner there. There was every single, it was like I would go there straight from school. Like, nobody had any questions about it. Like, that's just what we did. And I would park myself on the couch there because we couldn't watch TV. Couldn't watch the games in my house. So I would go. You should figure out a way to make it work. And throughout high school, I guess there was this very interesting relationship. And I think this really, just to steer this for a second, a little bit broader, is not really about technology per se. Technology was one aspect, one outgrowth of the phenomenon of which I'm about to describe. But we have a fascinating relationship in general with limits. We have a very, very interesting, especially during the adolescent years, we have a fascinating relationship with limits. On the one hand, we don't want them. We spend a lot of time and energy trying to figure out how to unlimit ourselves, how to get around limits. It's certainly limits that are placed upon us from the outside, how to organize my life in which I don't feel limited, in which I feel like I can do anything and all, you know, everything and anything all at once. On the one hand, we run away from limits. And on the other hand, we know that we really need them. It's a fascinating place to be, especially in the high school, certainly the later high school years in life, in which you're starting to develop a little bit of a sense of mature independent thinking, and you sort of have a sense of like, I want to do something in life, whether that's something that's inherently productive or something that's, you're just fun, but there's certain things that I want to do, certain goals I have, certain things I want to accomplish. And there is a sort of internal paradox in our psyche at all times. On the one hand, we do not want to be encumbered and hindered and limited. And on the other hand, we know we need to be. And this, I think, typified a significant extent of my kind of young adulthood. Which is that there were these limits, and we were different, and I think Rabbi Yisrael will get a chance to talk about that aspect of it to a little bit of a greater degree. But there were limits, and there were things that restricted me that were annoying. There were things that I just couldn't do. And it's sort of in the back of your mind, you kind of know that, like, yeah, like it's I can't say that it's not right. But at the same time, you try to free yourself. And I think that's what I kind of want to zone in on for just a couple more minutes before I turn the floor back over. You know, there's a funny phenomenon, and I teach in a yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. So there's a fascinating phenomenon in which you have a guy come over to you and say, "Rav, I want you to put a screen time limit on my phone. I want you to put a limit on my phone. Maybe I want you to filter. I want you to get, and I want you to have the password, and don't tell it to me." Now that, if we think about it, is an utterly ridiculous thing for somebody to do. Like, I don't understand. If you want the thing on your phone, so put it on your phone. If you don't want it on your phone, so don't. Why would you ever have a scenario in which you want the limit on your phone, but you want me to have the password so that you can't change it? That makes sense. If you want it, then keep it. If you don't want it, then don't keep it. But what is this me part? What are you coming to me for to keep your password so that you don't shoot yourself in the foot? And the answer is just as obvious as the question. The answer is because you won't. Because despite the fact that you want this, despite the fact that you know this is good for you, and props to that guy for making a decision which is clearly difficult for him, you won't. Another thing I never understood, which is the same thing, I ruined the punchline already. I never understood personal trainers. What's the deal with a personal trainer? You hire a guy to do what? To tell you what exercises to do? Well, you can't figure out what exercises to do? Bro, it's push-ups. Like, what's the big deal? Like, just do them. You know, everyone knows what a push-up is. Well, you want to, like, you buy yourself some weights and do curls. You've never seen curls before. What do you need the personal trainer for? What? Because you're going to, like, give you some, like, super specific regimen? No, he's not. He's going to tell you, hit the ground and do 20 push-ups and do them 3 times. Like, that's what they do. What do you need a personal trainer for? What's the answer? The biggest answer is because you won't. Because you won't. Because you need somebody outside of you. We need somebody outside of us to help bring out the best in what we can be. We need limits. We need gedarim. We need certain things that something from the outside is going to place on us, some kind of a structure that can actually help us bring out and be the best that we can be. The mashal I love to give is the following with this. The mashal I love to give is the following. You ever hear like in your backyard, you're like a water fight. So like someone brings out the hose, right? So you turn on the hose and like the water comes out and it kind of just like kind of slowly splashes out of the hose, you know? So it's not really a very good thing to use in a water fight. What do? Put your finger on it. You put your finger on it. You restrict the area in which the water can come out. And all of a sudden, psst, all of a sudden it's powerful. All of a sudden, it's a jet. What'd you do? The water had a large hole for which it come out. It could just come out wherever it wanted. And because it could go wherever it wanted, it could do anything. The minute you restrict the area in which it can come out, boom, you have power. Does anybody here know how much water flows over the Niagara Falls every day? Me neither. But I looked up, because this is about AI, so I asked ChatGPT,
the following question. How much electricity can be generated by the water that falls over the Niagara Falls every day?
Let everybody know the answer. Aha. This one I got.
The answer is approximately, it depends. Actually, it depends. I didn't know this either, by the way. They actually change the amount of water that flows over the Niagara Falls depending on if it's peak tourist season or not. I didn't know that. And it also depends if it's night or day. Didn't know that either. That's really cool. And it's actually a really significant difference. I would love to see what the Niagara Falls looks like not during peak tourist season. Is it, like, not so impressive? I don't know. Have anyone ever here been to Niagara Falls? I've been to Niagara Falls a couple of times. It's unbelievable. Like, the power. Like, you go there, you're like, it's not describable. The power is unbelievable. How much electricity can be generated from the Niagara Falls if it were completely harnessed? The answer? Approximately 1.4 gigawatts. All right. Okay, so I asked ChatGPT, give me a little context. What in the heck is 1.4 gigawatts? He said, the ChatGPT said, approximately the size of a large nuclear reactor. Enough to power approximately a million average homes in the United States. Whoa. Let me ask a follow-up question. How much power is generated from the Niagara Falls? Zero. Zero. Because left unharnessed, left unchecked, left to just fall where it may, it produces nothing. Beautiful. Very loud. Get you wet. Zero homes being powered by the Niagara Falls. Now, for the record, the Niagara River is one of the largest energy sources in all of North America. That's the part they don't let fall over the falls. Fascinating thing. Limits are what enable us to produce. Boundaries, stopping something from just going wherever it wants to. And guess what? The more powerful the thing, the more boundaries we need. The more powerful the thing, the more we need to be super, super careful with how, where, when, and why.
Imagine you had a gun. You own a gun. Hey, here in Israel, I know a lot of people own guns. I could get one if I try the streets. I think my street is actually eligible. We're technically a frontier town. I can get a gun. What if I had a gun? Just like leave it out on the kitchen table for your kids? Just like leave it there, you know? It's a big deal. Well, yeah, they're going to do something stupid with it.
The more dangerous, the more powerful something is, the more careful you gotta be
with where it's left around, how it's used, what you do, what you...
We got loaded guns in our pocket all the time. We're interacting with loaded guns every which way we go. Gotta make sure it's channeled. Gotta make sure it's safe. Gotta make sure that it's used in the right way. Let's embrace limits.
Let's embrace a little bit of the limitations that we might have, whether they're imposed on us from outside or not. Let's embrace it a little bit.
And let's use those things to hope, help us make ourselves the best us we can be. Piggybacking off of where Rabbi Yaman left off, I believe that there are two different types of limitations when it comes to setting boundaries that can exist. When reflecting back on the tech limitations that were perhaps given to me and that were presented in my childhood, there were many people who saw the title of tonight's discussion and they asked me, what restrictions did you really have on tech growing up, and what did you want that you couldn't have? When I was trying to think and reflect a little bit, I don't really know so much. I know there were rules in my house growing up as to when and how and what type of devices we used, but I don't remember so clearly ever feeling that that there was a type of restriction or there was a type of something that I really wanted that was stopping me from getting what I wanted in the realm of tech, or really in the realm of everything. There are two types of limitations. When you try to restrict something, and when you try to set a boundary, You could set a boundary with a wall, which represents something that is there that does not allow you to go through. If you try, you will hit, bang your head, you won't be able to make it through. And then there's such thing as a boundary that is more like a line in the sand. A boundary where if I wanted to, I could cross, but I don't really have any interest. And I know that what's on the other side, I trust that what's on the other side of this line is not good for me. I don't. It could be that my memory is mistaken, and it could be that this is not accurate. But I, when I reflect and when I think back on my childhood and my relationship with restrictions, and specifically in the realm of tech, it was very much so the latter. It was that my parents were enabled, and they built a home in which it was clear what we do and what we don't do. It wasn't a fight of this we can or this we shouldn't do. Yes, there were things that we disagreed upon in different areas, but it was oftentimes very clear that this is something that you want to be a part of, and this is something that you don't want to be. I'm not going to put up a brick wall in front of you, but I'm going to draw a line, and you should stay within this line. And there was that trust that existed there. One of the things that I do remember and that do stand out to me when I reflect is the fact that there was certainly a sense of intentionality with each and every single one of those boundaries and each and every single one of those restrictions. We didn't just do things because that's what everyone else did. We didn't just do things because that was the popular thing to do. But every decision and every rule or restriction that was presented was one that was done out of, like I said, intentionality and with a thought process that can be articulated and can be shared. And just because everyone else was doing it didn't mean that that's what we needed to do as well. And that's the point that I want to speak about with the few minutes that we have left, is that understanding and realization that sometimes culture and society pushes us to do things that we ourselves are aware are not what's best for us. If everybody's doing X, then we try and it's hard to resist the temptation. But not only is it hard to resist the temptation, we convince ourselves that that is what's best and that is the right thing to do. There's a fascinating Gemara in Maseches Brachos. A number of years ago, I had the opportunity to go with a number of my students to Rav Asher Weiss, who lives not far from here, in Yerushalayim, in Ramot. And we sat in Rav Asher Weiss's house. And Rav Asher Weiss quoted this Gemara to us, and he shared the following insight that I want to share with you. The Gemara talks about Rabbi Akiva in the times of the Roman Empire. And there was this great, terrible, evil decree against the Jewish people, against Talmud Torah. And the Gemara tells us that Rabbi Akiva was makil kihilos berabim. Rabbi Akiva would go and he would gather groups of people, and he would teach them Torah in public. And there was a man by the name of Pappas ben Yehuda, and he came to Rabbi Akiva, and he said, Rabbi Akiva, you're crazy. You've lost your mind. The Romans do not know what's going on out there. They're going to find you, they're going to capture you, and they're going to kill you. And in parentheses, the end of the Gemara, we know the end of the life of Rabbi Akiva. That's actually exactly what happened. The Romans conquered, they caught Rabbi Akiva teaching Torah, and they killed him in a brutal, brutal way. But Pappas ben Yehuda came and he said, you can't do this, Rabbi Akiva. There's a decree against the Jews. You can't go ahead and teach Torah. And Rabbi Akiva said, let me tell you a mashal. Let me tell you a parable. He said, once upon a time there was a fox that was walking on the riverbanks. And you may be familiar with this story. Fox that was walking on the riverbank. And he looked into the river in front of him, or the side of him. And he saw that there was a group of fish. And the fish were quickly moving from one side to another, very close together, moving swiftly from side to side. And the fox turned to the fish and he said to the fish, the head, the leader of the group, what are you doing? What's going on here? Why are you guys moving so quickly? Where are you headed? So the leader of the fish said, well, actually, we're not going anywhere. But down there, over there, there is a group of fishermen. And they have nets, and they have rods, and they're hungry. And they want to capture us. They want to kill us, and they want to eat us. And we are running away
from those nets, from those fishermen, from those rods. The fox turned to the fish. He says, that sounds pretty scary. I feel for you. I have an idea. Why don't you come on to the Yabasha, come on to the dry land here together with me. Kashim Shadaru Avosayim Avosaytan, just like it always was back in the day, your father and your grandparents used to live together with my father and my grandparents. Come on to dry land, and you won't have that issue. There are no fishermen, there are no people trying to capture you up here. There are no nets and there are no rods on dry land. And the fish turn to the fox and they say to him, Ata pithin shebechayus? Are you the one that they exclaim, that they say, that they declare is the wisest of the animals? That is the silliest things. Tipesh ata, says the fish. That's the most ridiculous suggestion I've ever heard in my whole entire life. If we're here in the river, in the water, at least we have a percentage of survival. There's a slight chance that we make it out alive. But if we come onto dry land, if we follow your suggestion, there's no chance we can survive. And Rabbi Akiva turns to Pappas Ben Yehuda and he says, that's my relationship with Torah. Yes, I know the decree of the Romans. I know that they're out there and they're looking for people who are teaching and learning Torah, and if they find me, they're going to kill me. But your suggestion to stop teaching and to stop learning Torah altogether is the most ridiculous. It's going to kill me for sure. So I might as well take the chance. Halavai, you should all have the relationship with Torah, with Talmud Torah, with teaching Torah that Rabbi Akiva did, to feel that a life without Talmud Torah is like a fish out of water. But Rav Asher Weiss made a point in his home that morning that I want to share with you. He said there's something that is off about the suggestion of the fox. Not only is it silly, not only is it ridiculous to suggest for the fish to come onto dry land, his rationale, the reasoning, Kishem Shadaru Avosai Im Avosechem, just like your forefathers lived with my forefathers, is straight out not correct. It's a lie. He's not only silly, he's not only a fool, but the fox is also a liar. Never in history has there ever been a time in which fish lived on dry land or in which a fox lived in the river. There was never previous generations in which these two animals coexisted together. Not only was it silly, it was straight out not true. The fox lied in his claim. And Rav Asher Weiss suggested that is the world and that is the lives in which we live. There is a mob out there that is trying to convince us not only that their values are correct, but that their values are what we always practice. If you don't subscribe to this, well, your father and your grandfather, a previous generation or two or three ago, that's the way they lived their lives. It's a battle against values in which their claim is this is the way it always was and this is the way in which it is supposed to be. Rav Asher Weiss explained that we need to stand up and we need to stand tall and we need to be clear with who we are and what our identity truly is. What we value. And we need to be clear that our values come from the Torah. Our ideals and our ideas are rooted in Torah. And we can't be persuaded and we can't be forced. We can't be coerced by the society and by the people, by the culture around us. We live in a culture. And we live in a society in which technology has breached all restrictions. And I am here to say, it's okay. It's okay to be different. It's okay to put on limitations in places where other people may not. It's okay in other areas to be different than what society wants, demands, and expects
of us. You know, there's a story that I heard a number of years ago that I like to share. It's a story about a man by the name of Rav Yaakov Sherman. Rav Yaakov Sherman, one day, one Sukkot night, he was walking in Yerushalayim and he bumped in to the grandson of, or a descendant, a child, a grandson of Rabbi Friend, the great legendary Rabbi Friend. And he told him that he had an incredible story to tell. For those who don't know, Rabbi Friend is a masterful storyteller. And he told him, he said, "I have a great story that I want to tell Rabbi Friend. Is there any way I could meet him? I could come, I could tell him my story." So the guy said, "Okay," he gets this all the time. He said, "If you want, come over later." He told him the address. He told him where Rabbi Friend was staying, that Sukkot. "Come over if you want. We can see if he's available." So Rav Yaakov Sherman was in the area, and he didn't mind waiting a little bit longer. He waited until the time that he said, and he went and he knocked on the door. He said, "Can I speak to Rabbi Friend? I was told that I could come at this and this time, and he might be available." And Rabbi Friend was sitting in the sukkah, and they told him, "Someone's here to tell you a story." And Rabbi Friend said, "Yeah, sure, bring him in." So he gave him to the sukkah. And Rav Yaakov Sherman was dressed, wearing black and white, and he had some payas and a nice long beard. And he started off by telling Rabbi Friend, "I didn't always look like this. This is not always the way I identified. I used to be Kobe Sherman. I actually grew up in a secular small town up north in the northern part of Israel. None of my family, none of my siblings or parents are religious today. But I need to tell you my story and my journey. When I was 18 years old," said Rav Yaakov Sherman, then Kobe Sherman, "I drafted into the IDF and I became a fighter. And slowly but surely I excelled in my positions and I kept on progressing in my skills. And eventually I made it to an elite division in the Israel Air Force. And I excelled there as well. And I became a commander in this elite division in the Israeli Air Force." And he said, "My job was to train the incoming pilots. My job was to try to train them for these precision, these very, very, very slim and direct hits that the missions of the IDF, that the Air Force was taking out." And he said, "I would run the same drill every single night for months at a time, training the next crop of fighters, of Air Force fighters, of pilots, of fighter jets." And he would take off. They would only do this after nightfall. He would take off and they would have a formation. He would be the leading pilot. He would be the leading plane. And there would be four or five planes formating around him. And he would drop a flare. He would drop a mark. He would mark the spot. And they would need, those fighter jets would need to hit the exact spot that he marked off for them. They had these, it wasn't a real missile, but they had these training missiles that they would use. And he said, "Then my job was to quickly," again, this is at lightning speed, "to quickly turn around and to check to see which of the pilots hit the spot and which not." He would do this 30 or 40 times a night for months at a time. This drill, he would take off the formation, drop that flare. They would look, they would watch, they would see. He would quickly turn around his plane while they would continue flying. He would check who hit it, and then he would go back to the base and land his fighter jet. One time he was doing this drill. It was, again, the 10th or 11th, 12th time he did it that night. And as he's making the turn, he drops the flare, and they go after, and they drop their training missiles, and he's making the turn at a really high speed. And all of a sudden, he's hit with a bout of vertigo. He's hit with this intense dizziness, and he completely loses control of his plane. And he thinks that he's going up, but all of the dials on the screen are showing that he's going down. There's a dial right there, and there's an emergency dial
on his side in case the one on the main screen goes down. And he looks to that dial, and that dial also is showing that his plane is going downwards. But because he lost his, whatever, his consciousness, he lost his sense of direction, he was convinced he was going up. And this is all happening within a split second. And on the radio, they're calling from the command center. And the voice, Kobe, you're going down. Kobe, you're going down. And Kobe described to Rabbi Fran in that moment how every fiber of his being felt like he was going up, but everything around him was telling him that he was going down. And in that split second, he made the decision, instead of going down, instead of going the direction that he thought was the correct direction, to listen to the command center, to listen to the dials on the fighter jet, and he turned his plane upwards, and he saved himself from catastrophe. Rabbi Yaakov Sherman said he thought about that a lot, and he realized that in a lot of ways, that's what happens to us every day of our lives. We're flying a fighter jet, and we think we're going in the right direction. And every part, we're convinced, this is going to take me to the promised land. This is what everyone else is doing. And this is what society is teaching me is the right thing and the correct thing to do. And this is what my friends are doing. And this is what the cool kids are doing. And this is what everyone around me is telling me and directing me to do. This is what everyone is expecting of me. And therefore, I need to conform to those behaviors and those actions. Or we can turn around that plane and we can listen to the directions and the values and the ideals of the Torah who are telling us is that don't crash your plane into the ground. You're going down. You're going down. You're not going to end up. You got to turn around. If you want to survive, you got to turn around the plane. You need to be able to be strong with your values, with your identity, with who you are, with what you are, and what you want to be. Emir Tzal Hashem, we should be Zocha to internalize, I guess, mainly these 2 points, the idea of valuing restriction and valuing limitation, as well as understanding who we are and what our identity truly is, and plug that into all areas of our lives. Have a good night.